Tim, I've been watching this great new show.
Yes.
It's
yes.
on during the day. It's called Impeachment.
Yes.
It's amazing. There's like, it's like about this crazy president, you know, who did something and then they're trying to impeach him. And there's all these like hearings and all this drama. The only thing is, I feel like the character of the president is a little over the top. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for November 2019. I am your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the gravy to my mashed potatoes, Tim Nelson.
Tim, gravy.
Gravy. How are you, man?
I'm good.
I feel like it's been a long time. It really hasn't, but like, because we've kind of actually stayed in a nice, consistent once a month rhythm, but I feel for whatever reason, it just, yeah, it feels like month is too long. I need more of you in my life. That's what it is.
We need to watch more movies.
Yes.
That's what needs
it's
to happen.
It's true. Yeah. I have to give a warning up front, though, because you and I were texting earlier, and we both agreed that we're basically like not in peak form tonight. You're sick, I hear, right?
I'm basically sick in 2/3 of the podcast.
We've already talked about this. You're always sick.
If I'm sick enough, it gets even more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm not that sick.
And I'm completely sleep deprived because my 6-year-old has been up coughing with a sinus fever, blah, blah, blah all night. And my wife works an early shift now. And so I've been on dad duty in the middle of the night. So I'm basically a hollow shell of myself. And you're not operating at peak capacity. So if this happens to be one of our worst episodes, you know, a little
maybe
grace.
People will like the hollow shell of ourselves.
Maybe they will.
That would be good.
Yeah.
They liked all the fancy wrapping paper, none of the content.
You missed it, dear listeners. We just had like a half an hour theological like battle in the kitchen. This is us operating out of the worst parts of ourselves.
We weren't
very mad or anything. It was just
passionate. We were just blathering idiots.
Exactly. That's right. Right. And I think that might be a precursor of what's to come. So hey, I think the last few episodes have been pretty good. And if this one confirms our worst fears, go back and listen to the good ones. There's our warning.
Is blathering a word or is it blabbering?
I'm pretty sure blathering is a word.
I'll have to look that up. That's good. Somebody
we should look it up. All right.
That's
so,
what a blathering idiot might say, huh?
Exactly.
They might ask that question.
Tim's going to look it up. He's looking it up.
I'll look it up at some point. You tell me, John, where are we headed here?
So it's November, Tim. The holidays are in full swing. Do you have plans for Thanksgiving?
Do I have plans? Yes. I'm going to work at a hospital for 12 hours.
Oh my gosh. Are you working a double shift on Thanksgiving?
No, I'm working a single shift, but then on Friday, I'm kind of going to celebrate Thanksgiving, and then okay. I work another 12-hour shift.
That sounds so bad, dude. I'm sorry. That's awful.
It's all right. Yeah, it's awful. Part of I'm doing this residency thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a chaplain. Tim is who you want if you are dying. I actually literally requested him when we were on our fateful Mongolian grill experience. I said, Tim, I really want you by my side if I'm ever on death's door. And that is the God's honest truth.
And if you ate the fish at Mongolian grill, you may need...
That was weird fish.
You may need spiritual support of a chaplain.
Yep.
It's true.
Yeah. I think I was eating that fish when I said that. So maybe you shouldn't hold me to it. Yeah.
The fish there... Raw fish only belongs in a sushi bar.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't belong at like an all-you-can-eat.
Yeah, where they bring out a big bucket and it's like, what is that? Anyway, so, well, I'm sorry that you're working all Thanksgiving. I'm actually staying in town this year. I mean, we usually go to Michigan, but this year we flip-flopped it. So I'm in town and going to my in-laws. So that'll be nice. Eating all the stuff. Yeah. Tim, I've got two Thanksgiving questions for you, too.
Don't you ask this every year? It's like my Mongol questions.
Yeah, but the second one is a different question. But here's
what?
The first one. Here's the first one. And I think we've done this before, but I don't care. First of all, what is, if you can only pick one Thanksgiving entree and one Thanksgiving dessert, you can only have one of each.
An
what will
entree
it be?
And Thanksgiving?
Yeah. An entree and a dessert.
I guess turkey?
Isn't really? You're just going to pick straight up turkey.
Is that
as
the
your
only
one
entree that Thanksgiving
okay,
has?
Okay, fine. Like, leave out entree. I'm saying, like, a dish. Like,
a
let's
dish.
Say, imagine all the 18 different whatever Thanksgiving stuff you got going on. You can only pick one.
I just don't like Thanksgiving very much.
Really?
If it were up to me, what I would do is I would make sandwiches with the turkey.
Okay.
And, like, just, yeah, after the fact. But the actual dinner itself is... Everything seems like lumps of paste.
Wow. Agree to disagree. But okay, yeah. So you're just going to take turkey. I know you are.
Yeah, I like turkey.
What about a dessert? One.
Oh, man. I guess I would have to say pecan pie.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that.
Pecan pie is great. Love pecan pie.
With real whipped cream, a small slice. That'd be good, yeah.
I am going with stuffing, but like a deluxe stuffing, you know, that has a little meat in there. I think I've had that once, you know, where you get a little
like
meat.
Like organ
going
meat?
On.
Like giblets?
No, like a sausage-ish stuffing type thing. I've had it once, and it was great.
A scotch
like,
egg? Yeah. That's kind of what you're describing.
It was stuffing, but it had like this amazing spicy sausage, and it was just like, wow, that is everything I need. Just
is
right
it,
there.
What's
it
based? There's like several bases. Is it based in like cornbread?
It definitely looked and felt like stuffing. It just had a lot more
rice?
Than usual.
Was there rice in it?
No, there was no rice.
White bread, like
I just remember the sausage and the stuffing all together, and it was beautiful. That's all I remember. Anyway,
there was sausage.
Maybe I was dreaming, but I remember it. It was a few
years
ago.
I love it. I think that's a great idea.
And a big, of course, slice of pumpkin pie. Pumpkin tin, the best. I love pumpkin pie.
It's a weird pie if you think about it.
With
man.
Cool Whip. Because my wife is a huge proponent of the real stuff, like you said. You know, she got to make it and everything.
But Cool Whip.
I think Cool Whip is amazing. And I don't understand why there's all this hate against Cool Whip. It's like there's something so beautiful about straight up extra creamy Cool Whip that you get from like, you know, Meyer or whatever. It's amazing.
Yeah, I like it too.
I don't know.
There's something... Yeah,
there's something about it.
So 1970s
yes.
about it.
Yeah,
you know?
And you just can't quite get that in like the stuff that you make or the real.
We need some kind of partially hydrogenated.
Yeah, there's like 18 ingredients. I know it's terrible.
That some who knows what animal? I don't think there's an animal involved in Cool Whip. It just comes in tubs.
It probably is.
Like
it comes
margarine.
In tubs.
It's kind of like margarine's dirty cousin.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I
but
get
I love it.
It.
I love
I
it.
I like it too.
All right, second Thanksgiving question, more to the point.
Yes.
What is a movie that you are thankful for? It can be old, it can be new, but a movie that you're thankful exists.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Of course.
Do I see this every year?
Do you? I try to.
I love that movie.
I love it. It's like the only... Think of another Thanksgiving movie. That's like the Thanksgiving movie,
I
right?
was introduced to this movie when I was in college by my aunt and my uncle, and they watch it every single year. And then at that point they had a little daughter, but now she's grown, got married this year. And the message of that film is amazing. I love that film. I think
we've
talked about it before.
Yeah, we've talked about it before, but it's a great movie. And it is, I try to watch it every year too. Mm. The only thing that's weird about that movie is that one scene where Steve Martin says like 60 F-bombs all in a row. And it's like the only reason that movie's rated R, but the rest of it is kind of like this fun, like family comedy that could have been PG. It's like, it's just like, weird because when you're watching
Big Lebowski in one scene.
Yeah. I'm just saying when you're watching it, like with your mom or something and they get to that scene, it's just a little bit awkward. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I love that movie. It's
there
fantastic.
Is a way to avoid this.
Yeah.
Don't watch this movie with your mom.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, no, that's a good movie. Love it. I'm going to say The Fellowship of the Ring. So every year around the holidays, I try to watch the extended edition Lord of the Rings. I know I've talked about this before, but yeah. I was just rewatching it. And that first movie of the trilogy, just the original Fellowship of the Ring, is such a beautiful film. The music in it especially, it gets me every time. There's so many great moments with the Shire and the Fellowship. You shall not pass, you know, and then Gandalf, and it makes me cry. And then that moment with Sam and Frodo at the end, it's just such a beautiful movie. And I love all Lord of the Rings, Two Towers, Return of the King, but like there is something that feels very self-contained about Fellowship of the Ring. And if I had to go to a desert island, man, that's the one for me. It's just that movie
is
everything.
So you're saying just Fellowship?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I would love the rest of the trilogy, but if I could only pick one, and Fellowship I feel is the most like beginning, middle, and end Lord of the Rings movie that has everything you could ever want. Yeah, I love it. I love it. It makes me feel like coming home when I watch that movie. It really does.
You like it better than Star Wars?
Oh, yeah.
Attack of the Clones?
Oh, yeah. Dude, I'm so sick of Star Wars. I'm sorry. I cannot get excited for the new Star Wars movie. Like, I'm done. I'm over it.
Did you see the new preview?
Yeah.
It kind of got me a little bit goosebumped up.
I have been so disappointed in the new sequels. None of them have grabbed me. The only Star Wars movie that made me feel like a kid again was the Han Solo one, Solo. That's the only one that actually had the feel of a Star Wars movie
for me.
Which
is considered one of the worst ones.
I know. I don't want to talk about it. I'm a very strong minority on this one.
Do you want to watch Gremlins with me someday?
I've never seen Gremlins.
You should really watch Gremlins.
I should. Yeah. All right, Tim. That's it. Let's get down to business. So if you listened to our last episode, we mentioned our plan to podcast on The Irishman this month. That was the plan.
Hey, what happened to The Irishman? Yeah. Oh, it's Scottish. Never mind. What happened to The Irishman?
Yes, The Irishman.
I would love to watch The Irishman.
Here's the thing. It's Martin Scorsese. It's a magnum opus. It's getting all these great reviews. But the problem is that it's not coming out in a theater near us until like 7 days from now. And by the time we would have watched it, talked about it, I would have had like 2 days to edit the podcast, and I never would have been able to get it out in this month. So we're going to do it. We're going to just do it next month. All right. We're doing it next month. Because here's the beauty of it, Tim. It's coming out on Netflix, like streaming at the end of this month. So we can just watch it next month from our couch and then talk
about
it.
You said this to me before.
But this is true. This is the true one now.
Okay.
And they're also, Netflix is also doing it with this other movie called Marriage Story, which I'm really excited to see with Adam Driver and I forget who it is, but it's about a divorce. They have a kid and they like, apparently it's a devastating portrait of a divorce. It's my kind of movie. It's one of those movies that only I like. But anyway, but that's coming out on Netflix too in the end of December. So we'll be able to watch The Irishman and we'll be able to podcast it on next month. But this month we couldn't get to it. So we had to pick something else. Thankfully there are a ton of good movies in theaters again. This is like the time. It's
what
all
happened?
Happening.
I like got to the movie theater.
Yeah.
And it was like everything. I wanted to watch everything.
Everything there is good
and
now.
All summer I wanted to watch nothing.
I disagree. I think it's been a really good year for film overall. But you're right. Now is the time where I just have to live in the theater. Like I look at what's playing and I'm like, crap, I've got to watch like 4 movies by Monday. Like that's never going to happen.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
There's a lot going on here.
I know. So yeah, there's a lot of great movies playing. But the one I had my eye on was the one we're going to talk about today because it was making the buzz on the festival circus. And I remember writing it down back in like April when it won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. And so I wrote it down and it finally is in theaters and that movie is called Parasite. And that is the movie we are talking about today, Parasite. So
John, when you told me we had to watch a movie called Parasite,
yeah.
I was really,
I know.
I was disheartened.
My wife did the same thing. I came home and said, she's like, what did you see? I said, Parasite. And she's like, oh, is this some like dumb horror movie?
Can I
like,
ask you a question?
It's not.
What's your favorite Parasite, John?
Is there more than, well, I guess there's
something. There's lots of parasites out there. Maybe you ought to think about this.
I don't have a favorite parasite. I think they're all disgusting. Yeah. Parasites. Gross. What's your favorite parasite?
Ticks?
Ticks? No.
I like ticks. Not having them, but they're blood-sucking.
I have ticks, but it's just the kind where I like blink weird sometimes.
Oh,
yeah.
That's different. That's a different
tick.
These are creatures.
Yes. Like ticks? Is that your favorite parasite?
Okay.
Final answer?
And then what's that fish that lives on sharks?
No idea. Anywhere. You know a lot about parasites. This is great.
Yeah.
Wow.
You get like tapeworms, botfly,
yes.
Larva.
You see those in those weird Google images, you know, where like someone's like taking a pencil and like taking a tapeworm out of their body.
Oh,
and it's like,
gosh. I'm so glad we know what these things look like. They used to just be rumors when I was a kid.
You hear those stories. It's like this kid went into the lake and then he came out and there was this big thing in his body. It's like, what the heck?
Have you heard about this fish that swims up your pee hole?
No.
I'm sorry, listeners, but this is another parasite. Apparently there's a fish that will swim up your pee hole while you're peeing in the river.
Wow.
It finds you by your pee.
It's a punishment to all those little boys out there who make the water dirty for us.
Yeah, you think like the whole if you pee.
Why can't they show up in swimming pools and hotels?
We just need one of these and then one kid to make an example of at the hotel.
We need beware the pee hole parasite at the hotel pool and maybe we'll actually have clean water.
It will swim up your pee hole and then if they have it, like if they just, they don't even need it in the pool. They
just
need a little
need
tank.
A sign with a picture.
Like a little bowl with it in there and be like, there could be this in there.
You know how that diving sign with the guy with like, you need one of those with like the X over the
yes. Am I blathering, John? Okay, so check this out.
Did
speaking
someone
of,
look that up yet?
Thinking about blather, blabber, and blather mean the same exact thing.
There you go.
But it's kind of funny because to do either one of them is to talk senselessly.
Blather, blabber,
and keep going on.
I think blather's better. Anyway,
I like blather.
Don't play with that.
I'm sorry. I'm messing with the chords. See, apparently when I mess with the chords, I blather. No, I don't blather.
At least you don't have the cat attacking us. Last time we had a cat that almost ate all the microphones and there was this big 10-minute thing that I cut out of the last podcast. You're fortunate. You missed it all, listeners.
I have aggressive cats.
Anyway, so no, this movie is not about parasites, but it is, but it's not about those kind
I'm
of parasites.
I'm sorry about blathering on.
That's okay. So
I'm a blabbermouth.
No, it's fine. So I'm going to take the plot on this one, Tim, since you've so graciously, you've done it the last 2 times in a row, and you've done it eloquently. I'm going to take it for us.
Yeah.
I'm going to describe this movie.
Please.
Parasite is a foreign film. How many foreign films have we've only done a few, right? We did Roma. We did Rashomon. Like subtitled movies. I don't think we've done very many. So this may be, by my calculations, this is like our third-ish foreign film, okay? And it's from South Korea, subtitled, and it's directed by a guy named Bong Joon-ho. I'll be butchering all the names. I'm sorry. All the names. It's bad. But that's the best I got, okay?
I love that you're doing the plot synopsis because I would have done the same thing. You keep telling us. Tell us about the actors now, John.
No. I'm going to say these names and I'm sorry.
Why don't you just talk about the actors now, John? Because I know how
we'll
about
get
your,
to it.
Your
we'll
command
get to
of the Korean language.
I know. So anyway, as far as the plot is concerned, okay. It's actually pretty straightforward, I would say. So Parasite is poor family. They're living in South Korea, right? The family's got four people in it. There's mom, dad, son, daughter. So four people. And they're not like on the street. They've got a roof over the head, but they're real poor, right? Like poor to the point where
they fold pizza boxes for a living.
Yes, for a living.
It ain't working out.
And this fumigator guy comes like with this disgusting like stuff. And the dad's like, oh, leave the window open. Free fumigation. And like it just enters their whole apartment. And
I don't know if you've ever lived in a basement apartment.
No.
But there are a lot of basement apartments in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And there's a lot on the south side.
Mm-hmm.
And the basement apartment was a thing, at least in our town, that before you could afford to build a house, you built a basement and you lived in the basement.
Okay. You're building the rest of the house?
And then as you could afford to build the rest of the house, you would build the rest of the house. But these basements have a little bit of light they can kind of get in, but otherwise you're living below grade. The toilet, which I thought was funny, and this not funny, but interesting, this movie has to be above the ground.
It's raised up on this platform. Yeah.
Or it can't flush.
Oh, okay. That's why. Yeah, I thought that maybe that was a Korean thing, but like that is actually a...
It's because it couldn't flush. That's why it was in the... That's, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So yeah. Making pizza boxes, free fumigation. They're like the central conflict right away at the beginning of the movie is that they're trying to get free Wi-Fi from like a nearby coffee shop or something because the landlord turned the Wi-Fi off. So yeah, this is like where they're at. Okay, so but the older kid, the older brother guy, he has a friend, and his friend sets him up with this tutoring job. And this family of this girl that he is tutoring is really rich.
Like
and
they really,
really rich. They live in this beautiful mansion type house. It's got this beautiful garden, backyard, pantry filled with food, the whole
walls of glass, architectural features,
yes,
modern.
The works. And so
a Mercedes in the garage.
Exactly. So what ends up happening is that the kid, the tutor, who's from the poor family, he ends up realizing that this, through a series of events, the family starts having some needs. So suddenly he finds out that the brother of the daughter he's tutoring needs an art teacher. And he's like, hey, maybe I could have my sister come and pretend to be this art teacher that I'm not related to, that I don't know. And so they work that out. And then suddenly they work out a scheme to get every single member of this poor family working in this rich home, but they all act like they're complete strangers. And so they're all basically able to pull their money and basically enhance their lives. And the rich family thinks that they're just a bunch of different workers that have come to work for them. And that, I don't think I'm spoiling the movie. That's literally in the trailer. And that's just the beginning.
It's a hustle.
Of this thing. Yeah. It's a hustle. Right.
And they're good.
They're good. And they're basically like parasites, right? They're kind of latching on to this rich family. All their earnings are being pulled together.
Like a tapeworm.
Yeah. And making they don't even know. They don't know that it's like they're being eaten from the inside out, the rich family. Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, but that's just the start of the movie, because from there, it takes a whole bunch of twists and turns and morphs into a bunch of different things. It becomes a thriller. It's funny. It's got satire to it. It's really emotional. So that's just the basic plot that sets everything into motion. Is there anything I missed, Tim, that you want to add to that? Did I miss any important? I think
no,
that's like the basic outline.
It's a bizarre movie. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, Tim, I know that you were a little bit less than excited to see this than I was. I get it. But you graciously followed my lead on this. You were trying to get us to switch over to Ford versus Ferrari.
No,
Ford v. Ferrari.
No, I understand that's like.
It's okay.
I understand that film is garbage.
It's not garbage. It's getting good reviews.
It's garbage in its own way.
It's formulaic, probably. A little bit.
It's like...
It's got Christian Bale in it. I'm not opposed.
It's a Steve McQueen film of our era.
Yes.
Okay? Yeah. It's... Right. I get that. But what... Yeah, I think I was in the mood for that.
Sure. You're in the mood. You texted me, but it was a little late in the game. And being the authoritarian dictator I am, I said, no,
you
got to stick to the plan.
No, I just was like, oh, I wish we were doing this. I didn't say we need to do this. I was like, oh, I really wish we were watching this.
Yes. But you graciously went along with this. You went to the theater. What was your theater experience? When did you see this? Is it today?
Yes, sir. Whoa,
yawned. Tim's
it's
yawning.
Late.
Oh my
I'm sorry.
Gosh. We should have spent an hour arguing about
God. See, now you got no energy from me.
It's okay.
You have no
need
nutrients.
Some coffee.
I know. Okay, so here's what I did. I went to this. Yeah. Okay, so the theater I went to was the Marcus Ridge, I think.
Yeah, sure.
And this place makes no sense to me because first off, you can get pizza there, and they'll serve you in your seats, yeah. And then they have these lounge chairs that you push a button on, and like it's just like you could fall right asleep. Like if I were in one now, I'd be just snoring.
They're like heated. It's crazy.
It is crazy. But you know what they don't have?
What?
Butter for the popcorn.
Yeah, they do.
Not real butter.
Right.
Which is
fake butter.
Okay, so then I go to the same. I go to a theater down the road by maybe 5 miles. Uh-huh. And it's the budget theater that Marcus owns in Franklin. Have you ever been there?
Yeah.
Butter on the popcorn.
$3 movies and butter on the popcorn.
Yeah, so that doesn't make a lick of sense to me.
Yeah, that is weird.
It's like I can get like a $7,000 chair, but the butter is not on the popcorn. It's like some kind of grease.
It should be an option. I agree with that. You know, that's weird. That's strange.
It's just very bizarre. Anyway, so the point being, that's part of my theater experience was that I got to be in one of these loungers.
Yes. Was it a full theater? Because mine was, surprisingly. That was weird.
It was the smaller screens.
Okay. Because mine actually was like packed out, and like I mean the theater wasn't that big, to be fair. Like you said, it was a smaller screen, but it was actually full, and that was kind of cool.
And there's probably like 9 people in mine.
Okay. And what was cool about my theater was that there was actually quite a few people that looked like, I could be totally off on this, but looked like they were kind of Korean descent. And I was thinking it would be cool if they were, and they were able to speak the language, if they could actually tell how much the subtitles are butchering it. Like, I think that would be really cool if you could speak two languages and you could be like, that is such a dumbed down version of what they're actually saying. You know, I wonder.
It's possible if you can do that with, you know, captions on your TV and go like, hey, that's not what happened.
If
you take a foreign film that has an English speaker in it and then you put your subtitles on, then you can evaluate how well they're translating.
But they would have to be an English speaker in a foreign film. I'm saying, but you have to, it would be cool if you knew like French and English and then you could really compare what's like.
Oh, that's true.
That would be cool. Anyway, but I think it's kind of cool that there were a lot of Korean people there because like how often do we get a film from South Korea? I mean, and this was playing in like every theater in our town, which is kind of rare for a foreign film. Like it was a pretty wide release.
It was a wide release. Yeah. I was really surprised.
Yeah, that's cool. Anyway, I do have to share one thing, though. I was, so, you know, like you were talking about the seats. So the Ridge is probably the exact same as the theater I went to where you've got these like love seat. Like it's a row of basically love seats, right? And so there's a divider, but you get kind of cozy if you're sitting in the same love seat, right? Kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like
They're made for couples.
They're made for couples, right? So I go there and I'm like I like to be dead center on the screen. So I'm like,
simply
oh, okay.
Because you're new.
And this theater has,
go ahead.
This theater had reserved seats, so I like get in my reserved seat. I'm like, I just want to scooch over a little bit to the left side of this love seat because I'm a little more centered, right? This guy comes with like his brother or whatever. He comes up and he's like, oh, that's my seat. And I'm like, well, I look over. There's like no one to the left of me. I'm like, well, you could just like go there. And he's like, that's my seat. So I literally have to scooch over and get really comfortable with this complete stranger for the whole movie. And it was an early show. I didn't shower that day because I was just like, you know, going to the theater. I thought there would be no one there. So I'm like all up close and personal with this weird dude right next to me. And I don't think I smelled very good, but that was his fault
because
he
great.
Could have just sat over
but
the left.
But isn't that a great thing for this film?
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of is.
Because they
right.
talk about the smell of poverty, John.
Yes.
And you brought it with
you. I think I did. With my college loans, I smell like poverty 24/7.
That's right. People are like, oh, I can't smell any money in that guy's wallet. Oh, that's what's going on.
Exactly. So anyway, that's my theater story. All right. Let's talk about the acting. You called it. We're going to talk about it. Now, the problem, as you alluded to, is that these are all foreign actors, and we usually spend like, you know, 15 minutes talking about the filmography of like Christian Bale or whatever, but like, I don't know any of these actors. Do you know? Did you recognize anyone?
I don't know if I know any of these actors because here's the problem is that I watched the movie and that's how I prepared it.
Yeah, that's okay.
Podcast. I watched the movie. I didn't read anything.
But you didn't recognize any of the, did you?
No.
I didn't. No, I didn't. So we're going to have to speak on some general terms here, but I do think that the acting was great in the movie. I think everyone acted their part well, right? Like, I mean, if you think about the families, one of the things you have to do is you have to come up with some natural chemistry as a family unit. And I thought especially the poorer family that we see from the beginning has this very, it has an intimacy to them that is really tangible, that like you pick up on, like they're joking around with each other. There's this familiarity. And I think that was acted very well. What did you think, just on general terms, as far as acting is
concerned? Yeah, I thought it was a good film.
Yeah.
I think the acting was good. I mean, in as much as, like, I don't speak the language, right, but it just seemed like just some good quality acting.
They felt like they had a rapport together, yeah, right? Like they were an authentic family. And then as far as directing is concerned, we're at also a similar disadvantage. Now, like I said, the director is Bong Joon-ho. I'm probably butchering that, but that's the director. I've never seen anything he's done. I do know that he came out with a movie that got a lot of buzz a while ago, which was called The Host. That was back in 2006. Everyone was talking about it, but I never actually saw it. So I don't think I've seen anything else that this director has done. Tim, are you in the same boat?
Well, there's a couple. Is it Snowpiercer?
Snowpiercer I've heard of, but I never saw it.
And then there's, what's the other one that is the, it's the one with the pig on the, or not a pig, it's like a fictional creature on the front. I can't remember the name of it.
I don't know.
Anyway, yeah, so no, and I haven't watched a lot of stuff, and so I'm ill-informed.
Yep, that's okay. So we haven't seen anything else he did, but we can talk about how the directing was of this movie.
Okja, that's what it is.
Oh, okay, I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a genetically modified super pig. So anyway, I think I might have like started that film and never finished it. I think it's on Netflix.
Okay. So yeah, we're a little ill-informed when it comes to him, and we can only really go on what we have got with this film going on. But he was the co-writer of this movie, and he was the director. So Tim, what do you see? If you just look at this film in a vacuum, as the first time you're watching this director in action, what do you see? What does he bring to, what's his style?
Symbolism, parallelism. Everything is crafted. It's kind of like when, yes, we talked about, and I'm not just because it's when we talk about Kurosawa, you get some similar things going on here. And I'm not, and it's not because it's not like an Asian similarity. I think this guy actually is influenced by Kurosawa,
mm-hmm,
which, yeah, makes some sense. But nothing is happenstance. Everything is like super well thought out. There's tons, yes, of metaphor. Windows matter. I mean, it's just, I don't know. People love windows.
I totally agree. Like that opening shot, you know, that opening shot with the socks just hanging there? You think, oh, that's a nice opening shot. But that actually matters and it packs a punch, yeah, later on, right? Yeah. Everything's like that. It's like a very precise movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I felt the same.
Then ascending and descending is big. We even in our Joker movie, we have that going on too, mm-hmm, except more effectively in this movie.
Or more obviously.
So, yeah.
Or in the Joker film. Yeah. Yeah, it's more the nose.
But the idea being like ascent and descent has symbolism and meaning.
Mm-hmm. And then the writing, like it's a little hard because like it's subtitled, so we don't really know the actual, you know, firsthand language. But I feel like what we saw as far as the subtitles are concerned was it was a very precise script as well. Like it was witty and there were some really profound lines, and that it's like just like the directing, that felt really razor sharp to the writing of it. So
yeah.
And then I like also how the film evolves, how he kind of leads you on this journey, right? It starts off as one thing. It kind of starts off like we were talking when the plot I outline is kind of this goofy sort of family comedy a little bit, and then it becomes something much more like Hitchcockian, you know, very,
yeah,
suspenseful. And then there's some, like you said, major symbolism with which we'll get to, of course, and then it leads to a really good climax, which I thought he stuck the landing really well on that. I'm a sucker for a great ending, and I thought he brought everything to a really good final punch there at the end. So yeah, I feel like overall this is a director who's firm control of his craft. He's definitely got everything going on, the colors, the detail, the tightness of everything. And there's just not a wasted moment, like Tim was saying. And I thought it was a really good experience from that angle. So, all right, Tim, let's just dive into some themes here, okay? Because I feel like we're a little limited in the directing and acting, which we usually aren't, but because we just aren't as familiar with the work. But I think one thing that really I noticed off the bat with this movie was that sometimes, and I mentioned this before, the thing that I struggle with foreign films sometimes is that I feel like the style is often different from what I'm used to, right? Which makes total sense. There's just a different kind of way that other cultures make movies. And there's usually some kind of cultural symbolism at work that I'm not familiar with, that I feel like if I just knew this one reference, then it would make so much more sense. But I felt like this movie was different in that it was completely 100% relatable. Like, I feel like you could take this movie, plug it into any culture, any language, and it would work just as well. It has a totally relatable universal story. Do you agree with that?
I think there's some of it I agree with. I think there's different class structures and different societies.
Sure, sure, sure.
And so, and that, that class mean has a different meaning in different places, and that we in the United States may not fully appreciate class systems because we have a myth of class dynamism that we hold on to.
Can you expand on that?
So we, like, one of our kind of myths is that you can go from one point in the class structure to another point in the class structure within one generation.
Mm.
And that does happen on occasion, but it's not usually the rule. Usually poor people stay poor, middle class people stay middle class, and wealthy people stay wealthy. That's not all. Like, I mean, in the last 20 years, it's become, there's decreasing middle class. And we have the poorer, and the wealthier, wealthier.
Right.
But, you know, we have the idea of class dynamism here, meaning that you could change classes relatively easy in the United States. That's the...
But it's a myth, right?
Well, that's what... Yeah, so that's what... Like, a myth in the sense of, no, it can happen, but it's not... It doesn't happen in the numbers that we may think it does.
I was listening to this podcast, and this guy was going to a Trump rally, and he was talking about how he was talking to some Trump supporters, and they were saying, and he was asking them about taxes, you know, and like, you know, if, because they didn't have healthcare and they were struggling, right? They didn't have healthcare, and he was asking them, and he was like, so what if we just raise your taxes like 1%? And then everyone has healthcare, including you. And they were like, no, I don't want to do that, because someday when I'm wealthy, then I'm not going to want that tax increase, right? And it was like, this would help them tangibly now, but they don't want the tax increase later because they think they're one step away from being millionaires, and then that would eventually hurt them. And I feel like that's kind of the myth, is that everyone believes that they're just a few decisions away from holding on to that, you know, or getting that American dream and becoming, you know, a success or a millionaire. I think that's interesting. Yeah.
If we're a country of immigrants, the idea is that you have to buy in that myth if you're going to come over here, unless you were enslaved to come over here.
Sure, sure. And a lot of people did achieve that. Yeah.
And so, but that's an old world thing. And also there's some people that think that, like, with the frontier, this is Frederick Jackson Turner.
You always bring us to great political philosophy. I love it.
So that basically when America ceased to have a frontier, I think it was like the 1870s, and it's defined by a population density, that we began to lose our class dynamism.
Hmm.
And class dynamism that's only really applying to white men.
Yeah.
Like, when we're talking about it in that sense. And it would be that there's this great amount of land and wealth, and it's being taken from other people within one generation, and now it's available to a new group of people. That's where our idea of class dynamism, where we see this radical class dynamism occur.
Hmm.
Or with us now, it's like that somebody could, like, invent an app and it would, like, immediately propel them into some new class of
right.
So like a Bezos type kind of thing.
Yep. But one invention away from being a billionaire.
Yeah. So we all think that we could be like Charles Foster Kane.
Yep. 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 Yep.
We see those things, and that becomes like the carrot, you know, on the end of the stick. But the reality is, like, okay, well, mom worked in the factory. Maybe I'll get to work in the factory. Maybe I'll work at Walmart. But generally we stick with it. We don't see a lot of class movement.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but this is addressing class. It's addressing people who want to kind of change their lot, change their station.
And I feel like part of the reason why it's relatable is because all around the world, we're seeing kind of an unprecedented amount of protests, you know, and a large part of it is income inequality. It's this anger that the system is rigged and that only a certain amount of people at the top are succeeding while the rest of us are can't even tend to our most basic needs. And that anger can take both a left wing or a right wing approach, but I feel like populism is the politic of our moment, and there are people taking to the streets in almost every country, and I feel like this movie kind of taps into that anger and that longing, you know?
There's a moment in the film, and I guess we're getting into this theme, where, you know, I think about Marie Antoinette that says, let them eat cake.
Yeah, Marie Antoinette.
And the idea is, the people have no bread, ma'am. Let them eat cake. And the idea being that the wealthy are out of touch with the poor.
Mm-hmm.
So that the wealthy want to throw a party while the poor have been flooded out of their basements
yeah.
and are at like a basically kind of a makeshift refugee camp.
Yeah.
And they're calling, can you come help us throw this make-believe party?
Yeah, the dad literally gets a call. He's like sprawled out in a gym with like hundreds of other people, and he gets a call, and the next thing he knows, he's at a store with this woman who's just throwing like everything into this cart that he's lugging around. And like the dichotomy of that is staggering. Yeah.
The rich have servants, the rich have property, and then mostly it's power and decision making. So they have choice over their station.
Yeah. And there's this one line that really struck me, because the mother of the poor family, the father of the poor family says they're rich but still nice, and the mother responds back and she says they're nice because they're rich. And I thought that was a really good line, because I feel like there's something to that. There was this article I was reading once where it actually said, you know, the idea that money doesn't make you happy is actually a myth, that up to a certain point, measurably, scientifically, money is correlated with happiness, only to a certain point. It's like up to like $75,000 or something like that. That money can objectively...
Like within the U.S., you mean?
Yeah, within the U.S., right. And so, and as you go down from that, if you go past that like threshold, then there's no correlation between happiness. But as you go down, there's an actual measurable...
When you have basic needs and you're going to lack for those basic needs...
Exactly.
And I'm talking like food, shelter, clothing,
right,
transportation,
right,
things to get to your job, to pay your heat bill.
Right. And there's books that talk about how your brain functions differently when you're operating out of that place of scarcity, right? When you literally don't know where you're going to get your next meal, that your brain is wired differently.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so toxic for the rich to like look down on the poor, because the rich looks at the poor and they're like, well, why don't you just blah, blah, blah? And it's like, you don't understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was there's a 2008 PBS special we have to watch for chaplaincy, and it's social determinants of health, and it looks at class structure. It's PBS, and maybe you can find it online, I don't know, but it's a movie, but it's a documentary. Uh-huh. And it describes that folks who have high amounts of accountability but low amounts of control in their job have high cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone. And it will actually, over time, will lower your life expectancy.
Oof.
And if you look at, they were looking at different zip codes. I think, I can't remember what city it was, if it was St. Louis, or I can't remember. I think it was St. Louis. And they had different zip codes, and there was a 12-year difference in life expectancy, and then the cortisol levels were directly correlated to that.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then the myth of the stressed out executive is one of the things they talked about also, which is...
Why is it a myth?
So it's a myth because there are people that have high... An executive has high accountability, but they also have high amounts of control over what they do. So they can set their schedule.
They have autonomy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so what they were talking about was like social relationships and primates and all this other stuff. And basically, if you are the alpha primate in a troop of whatever, I think they were talking about cocks or something, I can't remember, that the head, that alpha, has a whole lot less cortisol than the other members of the troop.
Yeah. So like Jeff Bezos can just sort of saunter into work and like, yeah, it's not like he doesn't do anything, but like he could just sort of take off and go like, you know, to France and suddenly, but whereas his most basic worker at a factory, like I was reading about their line of work, they literally have a robot thing that they carry around with them that says, you know, go scan this package and you have 30 seconds to go do it. And then once you scan the package, it resets and you have another like 30 seconds to go scan the next package. And if you don't do it in time, a thing goes off and you get a 5-minute bathroom break. Like that's what the lowest level of the company
sounds
is going
so
through.
Horrible.
Yeah, yeah. So there's there's that disparity, right? They're both quote unquote working hard, but like,
well, yeah. Well, I think yeah, but it's one of them. In both of those jobs, your ass is on the line. Okay, mm-hmm. Like, and I mean that like that's because that's what people would say. But basically, if there will be serious consequences if you don't do what you're supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
for the executive and also for the Amazon worker.
Sure, but they're not.
Either one could lose their job.
They're not comparable.
Well, but one would say, yeah, and there's arguments for all kinds of different arguments, but one would say that like all we're talking about is cortisol levels.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Amazon worker, higher cortisol because they don't have the autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the point. Whether it's oppressive or not, they have a high level of accountability. And apparently like 4 out of 5 men have jobs like this.
Mm.
And so that we that most men in our culture have high cortisol levels and our life expectancy is lower than people that are have more autonomy.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. You know, it's just like this common refrain to say that money can't make you happier, to quote that verse, the love of money is the root of all evil, right? Which is true, but it's also true that like some basic security that money brings can to cover your, you know, just like the basic stuff to cover your pressing needs can actually bring your brain to a place of rest that can make you a functional human being. And I don't think that can be easily dismissed.
Right. And then we get into definitions of like, what is need? So
sure. Yeah.
And that's a whole nother thing. Like what do people need versus something being like a want? And but, we may get in disagreements with our grandparents about this.
But that can be oppressive, right? Because then you've got like that rich congressperson who's like, well, the poor people need a cell phone? And you're like, well, wait a second. Like why do you get to sit down, you know, or like be in touch with people all the time? But like, you're going to say, well, the poor should be living off they shouldn't have access to soda or coffee. They should only have the beans that they need to survive. Why can't they also enjoy rest at the end of the day and enjoy games on their cell phone? It's like, I don't know, you get into that situation, you know, where it's like, well
I think just looking at what is I think that's what economists and ethicists and, you know, folks that are into that, they'll come up with different definitions of what that means. Because I mean, like standard of living, I mean, we look in the US and our middle class would be the, you know, top of the heap in most places.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's not to say that, yeah, so it's really like there's some level of relativity, but if you can't eat and if you're starving to death and you don't have safe shelter, that's like definitely a level, you know, that's pretty basic. That's like the hierarchy of need kind of stuff.
Sure. Well, and even among the middle class, I mean, like you're making a ton of money by worldly standards, but like when, you know, your college loan bill is $1,000 a month and what you're left with is basically a few hundred dollars, I mean, how rich really are you? I don't know. So I think this is where a lot of that anger comes from and a lot of the feeling of like, we did all the right things and it's not working, but it really seems to be working for a select few.
But that's not new. Like mm-hmm. that's
you don't think that there's been an increase in that sort of,
I think,
like,
what we're describing is something that is not new in other cultures. I think we have that class polarization, but that's historically been throughout the history of, you know, once you have, I mean, look at feudalism, look at plantation systems, look at all these, look mm-hmm. at industrial, look at industrialization of England, all these things, you know, would say there are haves and there are have nots. There are folks that are going to have that low autonomy and folks that don't.
The high cortisol and some with the low cortisol.
I think so. Except there is like, yeah, I think that's true.
What do you think is the film's ultimate perspective? Because obviously it's dealing with class warfare and some of the themes we've been talking about. What do you think the film is trying to say about it?
I think that the idea of, so when you have an elite class, it creates with an underclass, it can create a battle for the resources underneath that class. So that, like in this case, like there's two families that are fighting it out to be the servants of this other group.
That's so interesting.
And because that's the only way that they can see to survive. And so it actually takes two people that have the most in common, or two groups that have the most in common, and pits them against each other.
Yeah.
And tries to get them to do, and basically makes them duke it out while the upper class is totally oblivious to that, to them duking it out.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. This is a little bit of a spoiler territory for a little bit here, but like, yeah, there's a poor, the poor family that kind of becomes the parasites to this rich people. They discover there's a couple living underneath the house, like in this secret passageway that they kind of set up in the house a long time ago for like in case North Korea attacks someday or something. And so this couple's living under there. And that's so interesting. Yeah. You end up having almost three class structures that develop sort of. But like the poor couple ends up fighting with this other couple to survive. But like, what's interesting is that in that moment, you know, where the poor couple has our poor family has the upper hand over the couple living in the basement, you kind of have this feeling of, I think he kind of messes with us as the viewers, because I kind of had a little feeling of disgust for this couple in the basement, right? They're all bloody and they're just like, you know, just kind of like, oh, I'm like, please don't call the police or whatever. And like the poor family's mom's like, I'm just going to call the police. Like, this is like whatever. But then all of a sudden there's like this struggle that ensues and they have the upper hand. And so there's kind of like this battle, but it's like, wait a second, that at the end of the day, they're on the exact same level playing field, but there's this weird like class dynamic that almost develops between them, even though they're the same. Yeah.
And even in the end, they end up honoring one another.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
In different forms. So the two warring poor families end up honoring one another in ways that they wouldn't honor the wealthy. And you're getting
to the big climax at the end, right? Yeah. So
this film reminds me a little bit of a book that I've been thinking about called Hillbilly Elegy. I don't know if you've read.
I've heard so much about it, but I've never read it.
I had a friend recommend it and I read it. But the idea of like, and it's a good book, you can read if you want to, but the it's talking about white poverty in the Rust Belt, mm-hmm. and from folks that were originally from Appalachia. And so this guy's he ended up going into the military, going to Harvard to get a law degree, but he comes from a community that's basically unemployed, the unemployed sons and grandsons and daughters mm-hmm. of factory workers in Ohio.
Okay.
Anyway, but he talks about class structure, and then he talks about how the politicians and the pundits try to get the lower classes to fight it out in order to distract them from what's really going on.
Kind of like that analogy where there's a rich person, a poor person, an immigrant, and the rich person, and there's 100 cookies, and the rich person takes 99 of the cookies and said, hey, that guy's trying to steal your cookie.
Yeah, exactly. So you see a lot of that banter where it's like kind of a, and people don't examine that. What this guy was saying is, hey, this is BS. Mm-hmm. And he talks about all these reasons, but you know, why is it that, and this is all, I think about the politics of it, but like it used to be that Democrats and you'd have Southern Democrats and you'd have Northern Democrats and you'd have basically a working people would be in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And that has all changed. And so now what you have is you have poor whites are Republicans now.
Mm-hmm.
But like it may not be that may not be the party that's looking out for what they actually, their actual interests.
Yeah.
But the idea is that, well, these immigrants, these African Americans, these Jewish people have taken away something from us.
Yep.
And so I look at this class thing as being really important.
Yeah.
And it has, it, as far as like, how do we look at who we are, who, and how do we interact with one another?
So, staying in a little bit of spoiler territory, what did you think of the big climactic ending at the party? It's interesting how smell comes into play and all that, right? So, what really drives the dad of the poor family over the edge is, well, it's like a combination of the fact that they all think that he smells like cabbage, and that starts to like seep under his skin, especially in conjunction with what happens with their home being flooded and kind of that disparity that he keeps seeing. And then also like at the very end, what makes him crack and like turn violent is when he sees the father of the rich family like turn up his nose at this dead body when he's trying to get the car keys from underneath it or whatever, it'll basically run away. And he's just like literally holds his nose. And there's something about that that makes the dad of the poor family just snap. Right. And
you'd be repulsed by someone's humanity.
Yes. That's such a good way to put it.
Yeah. So that a human being would find something as small as a smell of someone else to create a distinction and then be repulsed by someone.
When people are bleeding out, like right in front of them.
The servants don't matter, but the rich people do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so it's a really interesting, it's an interesting dynamic. I think that was revelatory for the father.
Totally.
When he saw, oh, this is how it actually is.
Yep.
Yeah, you can let the poor people bleed out, you know, and you'll get the keys to take the wealthy people to the hospital.
Exactly.
Hey, your body is getting in the way of my of my my car keys.
Right. And then the last couple of scenes of the movie I thought were really beautiful, because like we find out that the rich family sells the house after that violent party, that this epic climax in the end, and then the dad of the poor family hides out underneath the basement in that place where that one couple once was. And the son has this dream to like buy, he finds out his dad is there hiding out in the house, and he has this dream to like go buy that house someday. And you see that vision where he's like a rich businessman of some sort. He just comes and he buys the house, and his dad's just able to walk up the stairs, and they're able to enjoy that garden just like they always dreamed of, right? But instead of closing on the dream, where it's kind of like where you walk out saying, maybe that's what actually happened, it cuts back to reality, and we see that the son's just sort of writing a letter dreaming about that, and that's probably never going to happen. And it's like that final punch to me that left me kind of leaving just like, yeah, really emotional when I left the theater.
Yeah. I think, and then the basement's metaphor, and that like all, and then the idea that all these old houses, all these big old architectural houses have a secret basement in them.
That they don't even know is there anymore.
The wealthy people don't examine.
Right.
I mean, it's there, and it's like, but nobody's taking the time to like examine, to like go, what's going on here?
Right. The lights are blinking all day, and they're just like.
Yeah. So there's the Morse code. Right. And that there's somebody. But the idea is that there's somebody who is oppressively beneath every single one of these things that looks grandiose.
Mm.
And so, okay. So beneath any of these things, there's a group of people who have to suffer in order for this thing to exist.
Wow. Yeah.
And have to compromise, and have to like, maybe their loved ones are hurt because of this. So I think that's like part, one of those themes.
Uh-huh. And what that one husband of the couple who is living down there, he's been living down there for years. He actually comes to like almost revere the rich head of the house as like a god almost. Right. Like yeah. That's so, yeah.
Right, because like one day I could become this.
Yeah, here's a picture of him, and
yeah, it's a little weird. And then the other thing that's so weird is the way that the wealthy try to distance themselves from the poor, and it's through art.
Okay,
and
what do you mean?
Art and education. So the things they got, well, it's all the things they get hired for, right?
Right.
So all the things that they got hired for was the wealthy people's attempt to let their children stay wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have an art tutor,
mm-hmm.
because they fear that their kid may have mental health issues, which would threaten his prosperity.
And an English tutor, right?
An English tutor, because if you know English, then you can get into university, and you get into university, you have the education where you can remain elite.
Mm-hmm. And it's like what we're seeing with Aunt Becky from Full House, you know, buying kids' education.
Yeah. The whole thing is Aunt Lori, whatever.
Lori Loughlin. Yeah, no, but Aunt, really. Felicity Huffman. Yeah, and
everybody calls her Aunt Becky. I love that.
But it's that they want their kids, even though their kids like come out and say they don't even care about school, they want their kid. There's like this desperation to keep them elite, right?
Right. And so it comes out through, so you use art and then education, and then to have a driver, which is the idea that there's one layer between you and actually like having to do anything. Like, so there's all these like layers that are created.
Yeah.
What's funny is that what occupies those layers in this film are actually the very things that they're supposed to be keeping these kids away from, which are the poor. So the poor are the ones that are meeting those needs.
The poor are the layer.
They are, right? The layer. So they're actually getting closer to the poor with those things.
Oh, that's really good.
And the housekeeper is the primary one. That's the primary one, which is the person that's actually running the house and knows more about what's going on than anyone else.
And the housekeeper leaves for 2 days. She's just like lost. Yeah. It's like there's all these dishes. Like, what are we supposed to do?
And then the wealthy people actually, they actually call the wealthy wife simple.
Yeah.
So she just doesn't comprehend basic things.
Mm-hmm.
So because she doesn't even, yeah. And so if you're looking at it, they don't respect her at all. They're like, oh yeah, you can trick her. You can trick her any day.
All right, man. Yeah. Good. Any more thoughts? Any of on the thematic element here before we move on to our final thoughts?
I guess, like, I think it's like, do we want a class war? Is that what the film is advocating? What is the film advocating, I guess, is the question. Is it saying that we need a more equitable redistribution of wealth? What is it advocating, I guess?
It's a good question. I mean, I feel like there's almost a curious amorality to the actions of the poor family, right? Because they're clearly being deceptive. They're ruining kind of people's lives to kind of leap over them to get into their positions and work and worm their way into the house like parasites. And they don't really, there doesn't seem to be any moral kind of conflict in their minds about it. It's almost like they feel like they, why wouldn't we be able to enjoy this too, right? And but it almost makes you feel a little bad, like that this is that they're what they did to the other people to get there. And then I start to feel a little bad for the rich family, like has no idea what's going on. I don't know. Yeah. So I don't know if the film is arguing that this is the answer. I feel like it's kind of presenting the conflict and saying, good luck. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's, you're supposed to have like this kind of like be provoked and saying, whoa, man, what should, I think we're doing what the film wants us to do.
Yeah.
Not even thinking about it. It's hard for me to really comment on it. I don't know what it's advocating in that sense. Is it saying that we need to be more cognizant of the poor? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't.
Yeah. It's like on the one hand, you're empathizing with the poor, but on the other hand, when the poor kind of takes what's theirs, then that doesn't feel good either. And so, I mean, the best art does that, right? The best art kind of presents, it doesn't give you easy answers. It presents real problems, and then it sort of lets you dive in and wrestle with it. The best art kind of lets you wrestle with stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what this movie does. Yeah.
I think it's, The father-son relationship was interesting to me on
yes,
this.
It really struck me too.
Because he, until his father stands up, like basically stands up to the wealthy people, the son doesn't respect him at all.
He's very passive throughout most of the movie. Yeah.
And he's like,
right.
Oh my dad, it's just some out of work driver. Mm-hmm, like that's mm-hmm. He doesn't respect him. But when the father stands up to the wealthy people, when they are basically ignoring the poor.
And his dying daughter.
It's like, yeah. And his dying daughter, he becomes almost like beatified.
Yeah.
And the son begins to have deep respect for his father. So it changes their relationship when the son sees the father act not out of compulsion to try to get something from the rich or to try to trick the rich, but when he acts out of an authentic place of anger and just a kind of like disjustified rage, right?
Sure.
Where he's watching people kill the people he cares about.
Yep. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Tim, what are your final thoughts on the movie Parasite and your letter grade? Go ahead.
It's not a fun movie to watch.
I don't know. But
I like the cinematography. I like the symbolism. It can be fun. I think some of the suspense stuff is really good. There's a scene where the family is hiding in the living room, and it's very, it's like super edgy because there's like sex and death and like, oh, everything's, it just puts you on your,
it's
like,
so good.
It makes you feel sick almost because it's so edgy. And I thought that was some great, that was just great filmmaking. Right.
Those
there.
Camera swooping like down below to them underneath the table. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like the idea, the constant, like we are underneath something.
Yes.
And we are below, everything's below, below, below. And I think that's kind of brilliant because it just kind of keeps throughout that.
The bed, under the coffee table, in the basement. You're right.
Everything is like underneath. Like there's a secret. And I think that's true. It's like the secret reality lies underneath this beautiful thing. It's not. Yeah. And so we need to start looking underneath.
It's kind of like Lynch Blue Velvet where that opens up to that beautiful like suburban. And then you go closer, closer, closer. And you get to the severed ear in the grass, right?
Yes. Oh, I totally forgot that scene. But yes. And you're like, what the? Mm-hmm. And so I think there is something like look below the surface. I mean, like literally in this film, look mm-hmm. below the surface and you'll see a different reality.
Cool. What's your letter grade?
I'd say like a B+. Real strong film. I wasn't emotionally moved by it, but I thought it was a really strong film.
All right. Well, I loved it. I'm so impressed with the quality of films this year. It's truly been a really great year at the movies, and I feel like we're just getting started. So I feel like I didn't have any problems with this movie. I feel like it's pretty much perfect. It's got everything you want. It's a great story full of twists and turns. It's got all the symbolism we've been talking about, and it's got a really universal message that I feel like anyone watching it can relate to, and I've just been thinking about it ever since I saw it. So I think it's flawless. I'm giving it an A. It's in my top three. What's really interesting is I was thinking, I have my top three of the year so far, and this will change, right? Number one is The Last Black Man in San Francisco, right? About these people.
You love
just,
that movie.
Just,
I like that movie. Yeah. But you love that movie.
But think about it. Just like the this guy whose only dream is to get this house, right? And then you have number two. This would be number two, Parasite. And then number three is Joker. And in all three of those movies, you're dealing with some of the same themes of class division. And she's like, yeah. Last Black Man in San Francisco, Joker, and this movie, those are my top three. And you're dealing with like that same kind of collective anger of people being trampled on and dreams deferred. And I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I think the class polarization thing is definitely key to all those films.
Yep.
And even with, like, I think of the, and that it would be something that is cross-cultural, and then Joker is talking about 1982 or something,
mm-hmm.
saying, hey, this happened back then, it's happening again. Why are we letting this happen?
Yep.
And then justifying, there's a certain level of, like, justifying evil because of the social, I think it all has social contract, all this does.
Exactly. I loved your meditation on social contract. Look up the Joker podcast for Tim's rant on social contract. I thought that was so fascinating. All right, Tim, well, there you have it. The movie is Parasite, and it might still be playing in a theater near you. Definitely hunt it down if it is. I feel like this is definitely a movie worth going out of your way for. It's that good. And hey, by the way, would you mind doing us a favor? Leave us a rating and review on the Apple Podcast app. I was looking, and our last review is from a year ago, Tim. A year ago was the last time someone rated us on the podcast. It's like, come on, people. Man, just one rating. We will read it on the air. All it takes 2 seconds, and we will read your review. What other podcast will say that? And also, heads up, we are expanding our horizons as far as podcast mediums go, because our podcast is not only on Apple Podcasts now. It is also on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, CastBox, Podbean, Podcast Addict, and SoundCloud. All those mediums. So you pick one.
I love it, John. And I didn't even know like three of those things existed till now.
We're out into the universe, Tim.
We're in what bean?
Yes, that is Podbean. Yeah.
I don't even know what that is, John.
And millions of listeners. Not us, but the Podbean. Maybe
okay.
us.
Okay. All right.
But I just ran into a listener of our show. I want to give a special shout out to Sam Considine.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Remember Sam?
Sam, what's up, dude?
Yeah. I ran into him at Trader Joe's, and the first thing he said was, I was just listening to your podcast, and because we don't see each other very much anymore, and he was like, I was listening to your podcast, and it's like, it's so weird to see you, because like you're always like in my head. So, and there it is.
Creepy.
So,
hey, Sam,
people,
what's up, man?
Good we to, love you,
good
Sam.
To, good to be heard.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for listening to us, Sam, and we love you, man.
Wow.
So, yeah. If you also love listening to us, please leave us a review, and let us know you're out there. And hey, why don't you go ahead and answer our Thanksgiving question? One entree, one dessert, and a movie you're thankful for, and send your answer to podcast@cinemafaith.com, and we'll read it out. We'll
turkey.
See what's out there. podcast@cinemafaith.com. Yeah, pick turkey, like Tim, the most boring answer you
it's
can possibly
so boring.
Get.
And it even puts people to sleep.
And don't forget to watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's a Thanksgiving tradition. And if you haven't seen it, you are missing out. It is an absolute classic. John Candy, Steve Martin, such a beautiful film.
Those aren't pillows.
Those aren't pillows. Love it. All right,
good,
man.
Yeah, it's been good blabbering with you, John.
I'm thankful for you, Tim. Yeah. I really am. And we are thankful for you, all of you, dear listeners. The fact that you continue to listen to us every month, it really does. It means the world to us. So thank you. And
thank you, John.
Yes. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.